And listening to all of us, I'm not near enough, am I?
Raise thanks. It a little for you, the tallest
you.
Readers we've had so far.
Okay, thanks very much. Thank you. My daughter, Elise, who's 5 years old, she asked me from time to time, what are you actually studying at Birkbeck, Daddy? So I say to her, well, I'm learning how to write stories and poems. So she says, oh, you mean for children, like the ones you read me? And I say, no, stories for and poems for adults. And then she says, oh, you mean boring ones. So today when she realised I was coming, she said, Daddy, are you going to be reading in front of the whole of Birkbeck? So I thought, well, it might be pushing it a bit for writ loud. I said, we'll probably get 25 or 30 if we're lucky. So not to be outdone, she tried another tack. And she said, I know, Daddy, I'm going to dress you up in a paper costume and colour it green. Well, that really stumped me. So I said, why green? And she said, well, you've had a croaky voice all week, Daddy, so I thought you should go as a frog. Anyway, no green costume, but my voice is still croaky, so I hope you'll forgive me. And I'd like to read this short story for my wife, Denise, and my daughter Elise, who sadly can't be here. The dance. At 13 minutes past seven, soon after the cemetery gates had opened, two indistinct figures stood in silence by the famous grave. Facing one another, mere inches apart, the couple seemed frozen mid-step in a dance. The man, in his early 40s, was dressed in a dark wool suit and a charcoal fedora. The woman, wearing a cream dress from Christian Dior and a brown ermine coat, was barely beyond her teens. From just outside the cemetery walls came a swift intake of air, followed by a reedy drone, as a street musician began to play a solo bandoneon. We can't go on like this, she said. One evening in the winter of 1973, the man, now in his 60s and chairman of a private polo club, worked late into the night for the seventh time that week. His Buenos Aires office was lined with alabaster busts, immortalizing the founding fathers of the club, all long deceased. Around him, formal family photographs were mounted on the smooth white marble walls. The man's thoughts strayed back 20 years to that liaison by the famous grave. He saw the woman's freckled face and fragile limbs, the spreading crimson in her cheeks, standing like a defiant sprite beside the marble mausoleum. Beyond the clearing where he stood with her, a maze of narrow corridors ran between the tombs. That morning in the winter of 1953, when he was 42 and faced her in the cemetery at 13 minutes past seven, he kept his silence and she was first to speak. We can't go on like this, she said. You say that every time, the man replied. One morning in late July in 1983, the woman, now in her 50s and author of a dozen romance novels, turned to her publisher before her seventh signing in as many days. We can't go on like this, she said. You say that every time, her publisher replied. The central London bookshop heaved with fans clutching copies of the woman's latest book. The queue wove back along the maze of narrow corridors which ran between the towering bookshelves. The lack of natural light and the dense high piles of books gave the place the aura of a vault. Among the fans, one face stood out, a grandmother in her 70s with freckled skin and sandy hair, had brought along a flock of sniffling kids. "I just adore your heroines," the grandmother said. "My daughters love your books as well. I guess you've got a brood like this at home." She turned to wipe the youngest running nose. "No," said the woman, "I never had a child." As she leant forward to sign another copy of her book, her left hand strayed across her abdomen and she let it linger there. She cast her mind back 30 years to that encounter by the famous grave. She saw the man's black hair and chiseled face, the early wrinkles radiating from the corner of his eyes, standing like a well-groomed stallion among the remnants of forgotten tombs. Beyond the clearing where she stood with him, the cemetery unfurled for over 13 acres, like a giant patchwork quilt. That morning in the winter of 1953, when she was 21 and faced him in the cemetery at 13 minutes past seven, she had her script prepared and challenged him. "This time it's different," she went on. "This can't be fixed with empty promises and new fur coat." From just outside the cemetery walls, the windy strains of the bandoneon swooped and soared. "Just let me handle things," he said. "You know, I always give you everything you need." "Not everything," she said. One afternoon in the winter of 1963, the man, now in his 50s and going through his first divorce, met his youngest daughter with her mother outside court. The girl, who had just turned 10, rushed forward and kissed him. "When will you be coming home, Dad?" she asked. Standing near them, just outside the court, a street musician played a solo bandoneon. The reedy drone echoed through the building's neoclassical facade, hewn from fine white granite. "Just let me handle things," the man replied. "You know, I always give you everything you need." "Not everything," the daughter said. She turned and ran away, her heels cantering down the courthouse steps like a young foal. As his daughter spoke, his right hand strayed across a scar which circumscribed his left ring finger, and he let it linger there. Memories stirred from 10 years back of that standoff by the famous grave. He saw the woman's wild hair, the colour of burnt oranges. He saw her firm calves above her high-heeled shoes. That morning in the winter of 1953, when he was 42 and faced her in the cemetery at 13 minutes past seven, she stood her ground. "Not everything," she said. The cemetery began to stir. The cats that slept among the tombs were now awake and hunting mice for breakfast. From just outside the cemetery walls, the breathy tones of the bandoneon were joined by a violin's plaintive meow. The man stepped forward to close the narrow gap between the woman and himself. "Just stay with me tonight," he said. "Things will look better in the morning." The wrinkles at the corners of his eyes deepened as he smiled. "Nothing ever looks better in the morning," she replied. The bandoneon and violin settled down to the smooth, even rhythm of quattro por ocho, with four quaver beats to the bar. The woman raised herself on tiptoes and kissed the fading creases at the corner of his left eye. "I only came to say goodbye," she said. She turned and ran towards the cemetery gates, her heels clopping on the paving stones like pony hooves. "You are the only woman I have ever loved," he said to her departing form. "And you're the only man I ever will," she whispered as she faded out of sight. One evening in late July in 1993, the woman, now in her 60s, dined with her publisher in a fancy London restaurant. The dining area's decoration, minimalist in style, was a subtle blend of white on white. The woman's 13th novel, The Cemetery, had just been rubbished by the press. The critic's greatest scorn concerned a love scene in the Recoleta Cemetery at dawn. After dinner and a magnum of champagne, the woman's publisher, now somewhat worse for wear, proposed a toast. "You are the only woman I have ever loved," he said. "And you're the only man I ever will," the woman whispered, her mind some 7,000 miles and 40 years away. One morning in the winter of 2003, the man, now in his 90s, lay half conscious in a Buenos Aires hospital. His private room was spacious and its ceilings high. The smooth white marble walls were sterile in their cleanliness. The victim of a second heart attack, the man looked grey and pallid, like uncut sandstone in a mason's yard. Surrounded by the offspring of his three marriages, who a few days later fought like alley cats over his estate, he reached out for the comfort of the nearest female hand. "You are the only woman I have ever loved," he said. The hand's owner, a fair-haired trainee nurse who had just turned 21, squeezed the man's rough hand with her slender fingers. Her thumb strayed across the scar that circumscribed his left ring finger, and she let it linger there. She blurted out the only words that came to mind. "And you're the only man I ever will," she whispered. One afternoon in late July of 2003, the woman, now in her 70s, was walking in the garden of her summer house in Cannes. In the background, on the radio, she heard "El día que me quieras," sung by Carlos Gardel in his rich baritone voice. Having just learnt of the man's death in the Buenos Aires Herald, the woman stumbled on a jagged paving stone and fell. Her publisher was at her side in moments. Seeing that the woman did not stir, he ran for help, his heels plodding on the paving stones like an old workhorse. "I only came to say goodbye," the woman said as she slipped out of consciousness. 50 years before, that morning in the winter of 1953, the couple faced each other in the cemetery at 7:13. From just outside the cemetery walls, the bandoneon and violin broke into a tango, sensuous and taut. Standing in the clearing by the famous grave, the man and woman exchanged their final words. "You are the only woman I have ever loved," he he said to her departing form, "And you're the only man I ever will," she whispered as she faded out of sight. Now alone, the man gripped the band of gold around his left ring finger with the nails of his right hand. He ripped it off, removing several layers of skin. He hurled the ring against the famous grave, sank to his knees, and wept. The woman, now just outside the cemetery gates, stumbled on a jagged paving stone and fell. She got back on her feet and staggered on along the empty street, not noticing the blood that trickled through her underclothes and down her freckled legs. One afternoon in the winter of 2008, El Cementerio de la Recoleta heaved with visitors. Nowhere was this guidebook-led invasion more enthusiastic than by the grave of Argentina's famous icon, Maria Eva Duarte de Perón. That morning at 13 minutes past 7, soon after the cemetery gates had opened, two indistinct figures stood in silence by Evita's grave. Facing one another, mere inches apart, the couple seemed frozen mid-step in a dance. A dance repeated every morning at this time. They had a brief exchange of words. She kissed him, turned, and ran. He hurled his ring against the grave, sank to his knees, and wept. She stumbled, bled, and staggered on.